June is Pride Month, and you may have seen hundreds of big box stores selling rainbow merchandise. But when did Pride become profitable? And where do brands actually stand on LGBT issues? Plus, thousands of Illinois residents have been affected by data breaches in the last year. We'll talk about what hospitals are doing about it and how you can protect your information. And we're continuing our week-long series featuring podcasts you can listen to this summer. We want to hear what you're listening to as well. Tweet us at 21STShow.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, two state attorneys general, including our own here in Illinois, are investigating a data breach that could have exposed millions of people's health information. Plus, we're also going to continue our week-long series on podcasts you can listen to this summer. But first, for those of you celebrating Pride Month, when it comes to what to wear, there's no shortage of options. A trip to the mall can end in all sorts of rainbow accessories, from t-shirts to shoes to makeup. So whether you're a fan of H&M or Nordstrom or Target, the rainbow signage points you to the Pride section. Non-clothing brands are getting in on the action this month, too. Companies like Verizon and American Airlines are all featuring LGBT ads and products throughout June. How did Pride get so profitable? And beyond the merchandise, what are big companies actually doing to support LGBT individuals? Tracy Baim is the publisher of the Chicago Reader. She's also the owner and co-founder of Windy City Times, Chicago's 34-year-old LGBT newspaper. Hi, Tracy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us is Brian Johnson. He's the CEO of Equality Illinois. That's an LGBT advocacy group based in Chicago. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Brian.
So for both of you guys, Tracy, you've been involved in media for more than three decades. I wonder when, from your perspective, you can share when the first company started reaching out in media for Pride advertising.
Well, in general, for advertising, I started in 84. There already were some little fits and starts with beer companies and some other alcoholic beverages by that period of time. By the late 80s, companies like Absolut, little larger companies were starting. And in the 1990s, I think there was really a burst of visibility that was happening in corporate America. Companies like IBM, American Airlines, and some others were tiptoeing into the market. Sometimes they'd jump right back, like AT&T jumped back out of the market when they received some threats of a boycott. So the 90s were kind of an experimental phase. A lot of it was very one-dimensional and focused on young white gay men in terms of images. They didn't get more sophisticated late until really in recent years.
And I would say how you think that message has changed, particularly now. I mean, it seems like there's just... So I feel like this year Pride seems like it's everywhere from a commercial sense, I mean, like when you're walking into a store, or you're looking at a magazine.
I think this year, in part because of Stonewall 50, has really been jump-started. And in many ways, it shows how weak that marketing lane has been because it's very surface. Many of these companies maybe are good now internally with their own internal policies, so that hundreds of them get 100% on the Human Rights Campaign Corporate Equality Index. But if you look further under the surface, they do very little true engagement and authentic engagement with the LGBT community. And by authentic, I mean really treating us just like any other consumer group in terms of supporting through foundation, through marketing, through using LGBT-owned vendors and media companies to tell that message. A lot of them really are still just at the surface.
I do want to get to some of that as well, and especially this idea of being treated like any other consumer. But Brian, I wonder first, Tracy mentioned Stonewall 50. Can you just explain that for folks who may not be aware of the historical significance of this anniversary?
Absolutely. So, for decades, if not longer, the LGBTQ community had been stigmatized and shamed and victims of police harassment. And 50 years ago, on June 28th, we saw a pivotal moment in our community's history when the patrons of the Stonewall Inn, LGBTQ bar in New York City, actually fought back and pushed back against the attempted police raid. This event was really led by transgender women of color, which is a critical part of our community's history. And this moment marked a real turning point for our community to say, you know, we are going to push back, we are going to be public, we are going to be proud, and we refuse to be treated like or harassed like second-class citizens. The Pride parades started the next year in four cities across the country, including Chicago, as a one-year anniversary commemoration of the Stonewall riot. And so that's why we celebrate Pride in the month of June, to actually commemorate this historical moment.
And Brian, do you think that's why? I know we were preparing for the segment, so I think I was paying attention. But when I was in, I think our producer was tired of me sending her pictures everywhere. I was in Washington, D.C., and I was in H&M, and there was like this huge video display and all the windows of all the shops everywhere, I feel like, are all. And D.C. had just had its Pride Parade, too. So I think that was part of the window displays. But does this year feel a little different to you also, Brian?
You know, I mean, to me, within the LGBTQ community, it feels different. I mean, there are a lot of us, a lot of public officials talking about the roots of the LGBTQ civil rights movement as grounded in communities of color, in transgender and gender nonconforming communities, absolutely. But I don't see that translating into corporate marketing and corporate presences. I don't see businesses highlighting, you know, the full diversity of the LGBTQ community and our civil rights history and riots and resistance, the way that I would like to see.
Tracy, to your point, I mean, I imagine you see this. I wonder if you see this maybe a little bit more cynically from a perspective of companies, how you would describe the way you're seeing Pride being marketed right now?
Oh, yes, I am a great cynic in this area. Part of me is on the journalist side. I know so much about some of these companies. Many of them give to anti-gay politicians at the same time they're giving to LGBT causes, or the amount they give to the anti-gay groups or conservative groups is so much more than they give token amounts to LGBT organizations and causes. And they also stay with the safe groups like the Human Rights Campaign, and they don't give to the National Center for Transgender Equality or something like that. It's also so many times it's driven from an LGBT employee group, so that there's one or two people that are driving the whole company on the issue, which means it's not embedded deeply systematically. And when those people leave, that history leaves and the work leaves. American Airlines is a great example of that. They had two internal great advocates, and then they closed that department, and all that history and legacy was lost. So it's not fully embedded within these corporations. It's very, to me, it is almost a cynical approach to reaching a community. And I treat most of the efforts out there that I see as very token. There's very, very few companies that get it right. And even those that do, it can go away in a heartbeat because it's not embedded.
And so to your point, American Airlines, it's interesting as you're saying that, Tracy, because to me, it sounds very similar to when people talk about diversity issues of people of color, that oftentimes they're driven by one or two people and maybe are not part of a corporate culture. And then when that person is gone, it goes away. Let's talk about, you mentioned some companies here, Tracy, and let's talk about AT&T, because that's one company that you mentioned as somewhat as company that has advertised itself as being LGBT friendly. But when we look at reporting, I'm thinking at reporting from OpenSecrets.org, AT&T has contributed tens of thousands of dollars through their official PAC to representatives who advocate against LGBT protections. What do we know about, for example, AT&T and some of the criticism they've faced?
Well, yeah, an article just came out on popular.info just in the last few days that showed that AT&T gave $2.7 million to 193 different anti-gay politicians. It's unbelievable, really. You know, we talk about Chick-fil-A or Cracker Barrel, some of the obvious targets of gay pickets and stuff over the years, but we're not holding accountable organizations like that. UPS, all these organizations, even Pfizer, that are promoting LGBT stuff this month, have given millions of dollars to anti-gay people and causes. So, yeah, no, it's a difficult decision. And you know, in corporate America, I know they have to lobby, and big tech giants certainly have to lobby. But there's other ways that they can compensate and, you know, do some kind of reparations. I would say this for every community, including the African-American community, all communities of color, that so much of the marketing is surface and doesn't have any authenticity to it.
Brian, I wonder how you feel like this should be navigated, because on the one hand, I imagine it's something that you want to celebrate, that this is, I don't know if bandwagon is the right word, but that everyone feels like they need to take part in Pride Month is something that is a good thing. But obviously for you and for Tracy and for people who are in this community, you want to see real change happen.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do have to say I feel very excited when I see Pride being marketed to the general public, simply because part of me is still that you know, afraid queer kid coming to grips with my identity, feeling like I was alone. And so I do like that. And quite honestly, there have been real leaders within corporate and business America who've stepped up in defense of the LGBTQ community. And we would not have seen the successful fighting back against the anti-transgender bathroom bills in North Carolina, or the license to discriminate efforts in Indiana, or even the push to marriage equality here in Illinois, if key business leaders and key businesses hadn't stepped up. There is that space that I want to honor. But I think Tracy is absolutely right. I mean, you know, it is not fair to say that you are, you know, a champion of the LGBTQ community if you're bankrolling not just candidates and elected officials who are voting against LGBTQ community, but in some aspects, in some cases, actually the lead opponents of efforts to cut back our equality.
So, Tracy, who's doing this? Who's doing this well? How do you think companies are doing this well externally as well as internally when we're talking about internal company culture?
You know, first of all, I would agree with Brian. There's been a lot of the progress of the last decade has been thanks to LGBTs coming out within corporations and media companies and making change within and forcing those corporations to do public letters of support. I think, you know, I'm hard-pressed to tell you anybody that's doing it perfectly. There are companies that are doing things really, really well, and then you look behind the curtain and you see the donations that they do because they have to. As corporations, they think they have to do it that way. They have so much clout. So even a company like Absolute, who has this great trajectory and great history, as they've been merged and corporate changes have happened over the years, that commitment has changed. And so I would, you know, I could name a few companies, but I would say that the chance of them changing course quickly it's very possible that they would do that. So there's, you know, there's terrific companies doing this. We wouldn't be where we're at without them. But I just ask for so much more than what getting 100% on HRC gives them.
Agreed.
It gives them too much of an internal pass right now. We need so much more externally. They can transform society with some not significant to them, but significant to our community changes.
And by that, Tracy, you mean foundational support, companies that give grants to small businesses or nonprofits. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at everything they do externally facing, if they worked with every kind of diversity that they're trying to serve, whether that's women-owned, African-American-owned, LGBT, throughout their whole structures, whether that's vendors that they use for any kind of business that they do, if they forced equity on all the subcontractors, all the things that they do across society, and if they did that in the business that they do with the government, they wouldn't work with government entities that were biased, et cetera. They would transform society. Corporations run the world. They are governments. And so when they employ 50,000 people and they transform the environment and all the vendors, the thousands of vendors they work with, how they buy things, you know, everything they do, that's a true transformational company. It's not easy to do, but it can have the beneficial effects we're looking for. We're unfortunately this horribly corporate country, and they control more than our government in terms of jobs and assets and everything. they could shift those assets to make transformational society.
That's Tracy Baim. We're also speaking with Brian Johnson. Brian, when we think about Tracy's point was to the external company culture. When we're thinking about internal company culture, what would you like to see in terms of employees and advocacy within organizations when we're talking about the LGBT community?
Yeah, let me build off Tracy's point there and get to that question too, Nyla. So just to provide a really concrete example, I was in a national retail chain's store this week, and they were promoting with a massive marketing campaign a $100,000 gift to a national LGBTQ group, which is great. This retailer brings in $75 billion in revenue a year. $100,000 to a national organization is the
equivalent. That's like 50 cents, right?
It's actually 7 cents.
It's
the equivalent of the average American household donating 7 cents. I am glad they did $100,000, but that does not merit back padding that I see them giving themselves. We'd like to see much more, and it should quite honestly be, you know, very local as well. We'd like to see them engage at a really local level with LGBTQ community groups at the grassroots.
And then to the point about the internal company culture, what would you also like to see in terms of, do you feel like, Brian, we are also giving companies a pass on how they're treating their LGBT workers, or where would you like to see that improve?
I mean, anecdotally, we see great improvements in that area. I think the greatest area for improvement internally is creating real paths for leadership for LGBTQ people. Until LGBTQ people, particularly LGBTQ people of color, women, and trans and gender nonconforming folks, are actually infiltrating the C-suites, we're not going to see meaningful change trickle down throughout the entire organization. So I would really like to see meaningful development in making sure LGBTQ people are assuming leadership roles in businesses.
Tracy, we're almost out of time. Final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Brian. It has to be at the top. I think equity and every part of diversity needs to be represented on the boards and the C-suites.
That's Tracy Baim, the co-founder of the Windy City Times, owner of the Windy City Times, publisher of the Chicago Reader. I want to thank Brian Johnson for being with us as well, CEO of Equality Illinois. Both of you, thanks for taking the time to speak with us about this. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thank you.
Back to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Whether we're swiping at a credit card at a store, streaming music online, or logging into social media, we always know there's a chance our information could get into the wrong hands. And unfortunately, news of such data breaches have become fairly common. But when that information relates to some of the most private aspects of our lives, like our health, that can be especially alarming. Earlier this month, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul and Connecticut Attorney General William Tong announced an investigation into a data breach at American Medical Collection Agency, which contracted with lab testing facilities like LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics. It's possible that breach exposed the personal health and financial information of more than 19 million Americans. We wanted to talk about this breach, but also what patients and medical facilities can do to protect our medical information. And for that, I'm joined by Rick Spatafor, a healthcare security advisor with Sentinel, which works with many Illinois hospitals. And he's on the line with us from Washington. Also joining us from Chicago is Lisa Schenker, a Chicago Tribune business reporter who covers health. And she's been reporting on several data breaches that have occurred at hospitals in the Chicago area. Good morning, Rick. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Lisa, I wanted to start with you and just ask you about, as we kind of seen news reports of data breaches, that's pretty common. I'm not sure we are used to seeing them happen. I think we tend to think this happens with a major retailer or a bank. But now we're seeing things at medical facilities. And you reported on in March at Rush University Medical Center, where information from 45,000 patients was exposed. How much more common is this?
Well, it's actually there are a number of data breaches that happen at hospital systems because hospital systems, like retailers, they have a lot of your billing information, but on top of that, they also have a lot of personal information, social security numbers, addresses, health insurance information, billing information as well.
And this Rush University Medical Center breach, that happened back in March. What happened there?
Well, what happened there is there may have been as many as the information of about 45,000 patients exposed. And that was a situation where a vendor of the hospital had improperly disclosed a file to a, quote, unauthorized party. So this wasn't a malicious attack, but it was an outside vendor that was handling some of the Rush information, and that's how it was exposed.
And then there was another situation with the University of Chicago earlier this month, Lisa?
Yes, earlier this month, the University of Chicago discovered that some of its donor and patient information may have been exposed. An independent researcher who looks for security vulnerabilities within organizations found the database and told University of Chicago about it. And last I talked to University of Chicago, they were investigating to figure out exactly what had happened and how many people may have been affected.
So in that case, it wasn't actually hackers. It was an outside security researcher who was maybe found holes in the system.
Right, exactly.
Rick, when we're thinking about this, to Lisa's point, how much of this is about getting people's maybe financial information versus health information when we're thinking about hospitals being targets for hackers?
It's always a combination. They like to look at things like health information and financial information, and healthcare is a treasure trove of both of those combined together. Because not only can you perform identity theft, but then you can also turn around and perform things such as insurance fraud, which they can get paid with your information.
Oh, that's interesting, Rick. So how would people commit insurance fraud if they had your health information, meaning they would be able to file claims? And how would that work?
Yes. They steal your insurance information and your financial information, and they can create fake claims, and they submit them.
Okay. And does that, when we think about hospitals, what kind of work do you do specifically then with Illinois hospitals? Do many of them contract with outside firms such as yours to work on security?
A lot of them do, yes. There's three things that hospitals need to do to comply with the HIPAA security rule. Annually, they need to perform a risk assessment. They need to do some type of security assessment. And they also need to ensure they comply with the HIPAA security rule by doing an audit. So those are the three main functions, and those are the areas that we help hospitals.
Lisa, can you remind us about HIPAA? I think people tend to think that's maybe more about keeping your information private from medical, from research and for hospitals, but this also has to do with your personal information when it comes to security?
Well, HIPAA applies to any healthcare provider. It's any provider that submits information electronically, which is pretty much every healthcare provider at this point. And that applies to a lot of your personal information that they have to keep private. And if they violate, when healthcare providers have breaches involving at least 500 people, they actually have to report that to the federal government. And the federal government can do an investigation at that point and potentially even fine providers depending on the severity of the incident.
And does that mean then when there's more than 500 people, Lisa, then is there an obligation to, a legal obligation or government oversight to inform the patients as well that your data may be compromised when it comes to health information?
I believe they do. I believe they do have to send out some sort of notification.
Rick, how does that work? Rick?
Yeah, anything over 500 number of patients breached, you need to inform the Office of Civil Rights. And then you also need to do a public disclosure of that information.
Okay. And so, Rick, when we think about that, I mean, are there things in particular you think where hospitals may be failing when it comes to addressing these data breaches? Are there things that there are specific vulnerabilities that happen with medical facilities that might be different from, say, like a retailer?
Well, the one thing that is a trend the past few years that has come out through the Verizon data breach report has been that healthcare has a significantly higher percentage of internal breaches as opposed to all the other industries. And I think that goes to a lot of education for your users, making sure that they're aware of the information they're accessing. And you also want to make sure that they're following the best practices. A lot of organizations, they jump right to implementing a technology without making sure that they're doing all of those other security best practices that they need to.
And Wook, when you say best practices, what do you mean in particular, Rick?
So one of those is performing a risk assessment. It's really one of the most efficient ways that a hospital can go through and identify where their highest risk assets are and ensuring that they're protecting those. So that's why it's required under HIPAA, and most hospitals could do a little better job than doing that. The Office of Civil Rights actually has some stats on this, and less than 20% of the hospitals in the United States are performing them adequately.
Lisa, when it compares to other industries, do you think that hospitals and other medical facilities are behind when it comes to cybersecurity measures?
Well, there are some statistics out there that show that healthcare providers are spending less of their total information technology budgets on security. Gartner, which is a global research and advisory company, found that healthcare providers were spending about 5% of their IT budgets on security, whereas banking and financial services were spending 7.3%. Retail and wholesale were spending more than 6%. Insurance was spending 5.7%. So there is a little less spend going on there. And when I talk to people about why that is, there are a lot of competing demands at hospitals, especially patient care. And I think if hospitals have tight budgets, in some cases they may want to spend their money on patient care more than cybersecurity.
And Rick, that is a tough thing because, I mean, especially when we're thinking about hospitals, that when their primary mission is to provide quality health care for people, maybe the notion of cybersecurity may be something where there may not be that much internal knowledge about it, but then that may also require, as Lisa's pointing out, extra spending. Obviously, this is your business to try to get hospitals more invested in this issue. What kind of case do you make to them?
Well, it's about awareness, right? And by being aware of your environment, where all of your data is at, it enables you to protect that data appropriately. That's the first step. And being aware of what data you hold, obviously in this situation, it's PHI, and what those requirements are. One of the concerns we have in cybersecurity is that as these headlines are decreasing as far as breaches go, the concern tends to drop from the board and the executive staff. And we go through and we want to make sure that they're educated as far as performing the assessment and showing them where they're vulnerable so that they can go in and remediate those items and secure the patient data.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, when we think about funding for this, I imagine obviously this is something when it's a hospital that they have to pay for entirely from within their budget, right? Even if it's a nonprofit?
The vast majority of hospitals in Illinois are nonprofits.
And when we're thinking about this on the patient side, Rick, are there things that patients can do to protect their information?
So I would say that the patients need to be aware of the information they're giving to organizations. You always want to be aware of the information you're giving and is it appropriate to the situation. Be aware of what data they're collecting it, and you have a right to ask every organization how they're protecting your data. Ask things such as, is the data encrypted? How often do you assess your security? Things along those lines, and organizations should be prepared to answer that. Also, if you are concerned with some type of breach of information, hospitals all have a hotline to call into to notify them of a concern of a HIPAA violation or HIPAA breach, and they will investigate that and inform you of the findings. The other thing to be aware of is there is a resolution within the Illinois House right now for privacy protections. So everyone needs to be aware that this is going to be cycling through, and these are going to be things that patients can use to protect their information moving forward.
Lisa, is this something you think people should be concerned about? I think especially when you're thinking about your health information, people might be exceptionally worried about their health information getting out there. As Rick said, it's not just your financial information, it's your health information. There could be insurance fraud. I imagine there's a lot of could be a lot of horror stories involved with that. Is this something that you think people need to be especially worried about?
I mean, it just depends, I think, on how much someone is concerned about their health information getting out there. I mean, everyone's concerned about their financial information getting out there. No one wants to be the victim of insurance fraud. And when it comes to your personal medical conditions being known, you know, it just depends on what your conditions are and how sensitive to you are to being out there. I mean, there have been incidents, you know, where maybe it was revealed that a patient was seeing a certain type of doctor and that information was put out there. But, you know, I guess it just depends on your personal situation, how upsetting that is to you.
That's Lisa Schenker. We will tweet out some of Lisa's stories she's been doing, particularly about the breaches at Rush and at University of Chicago. She's a business reporter who covers health at the Tribune. I want to thank Rick Spadafore for being with us as well, a healthcare security advisor at Sentinel in Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are more than 750,000 podcasts out there, 30 million episodes. So we understand it can be hard to figure out what you should listen to, especially if you've got some travel planned and you're looking for something new. The good news, though, is that there are shows about all kinds of topics. Whether you're looking for something light and fun, perhaps something you want your kids to listen to. We've been talking about different podcasts all this week. By the way, on that note about kids, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a favorite podcast for kids, please tweet that to us. Our handle is 21stshow. You can send us an email. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can post on our Facebook page, send us a message there as well. But we're going to be talking about that later in the week. Today, we are going to be featuring some more shows we're listening to. And the first one's called Self Evident. It's Asian America Stories. Kathy Irway is the host of it. She's also a James Beard Award winning writer, and she's on the line with us now from New York. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
So,
featuring Self Evident.
Yeah, so I think we should start with the name, right? Why is this podcast mm-hmm. called Self Evident?
Oh, great question. So, it actually nods to a line in the Declaration of Independence. It's right before, like, a very well known and maybe controversial line. So, it goes, "We hold these truths to be self evident, that all men are created equal." Right. So it's that part, which is, you know,
not the all men are created equal part. Right.
Yeah. You can think about that. You know, at the time, it wasn't exactly even, you know, true. But hey, I also think that it's really nice to have the word self in the name because, and also like our logo has like a face. It's a beautiful graphic illustration by Grace Abe of a face. So I think that it also alludes to the fact that these are very individual journeys that everyone has and that we're hoping to share the whole Asian American experience as a collective too.
And so you guys did a whole episode about this. And unfortunately, we do not have the great 30 minutes that you guys had to unpack this because this can be really complicated. But I wonder if we should start with the whole episode you did about what it means to be Asian American, mm-hmm. which in itself is a pretty big question.
Yeah, I think that that episode really, really unpacks a lot of what we went through when we were trying to come up with this, this whole podcast. So, you know, we had so many differing reactions to the term Asian American. So we want to sort of track where it came from, when it was founded in civil rights era, like movements that really helped define why this collective identity was useful. And we also wanted to see, you know, what's it doing today? Is it really serving the people that fall into this category? Is it, you know, is it relevant? Is it helpful? Who is it for? Is it for everyone under this label and so forth? So,
and is it for people who aren't Asian American? Were you thinking about that too?
I think so. I think with our show, we wanted to show that telling Asian America stories is really telling America's stories and that this is a vital part of the American experience or American history. And it's one and the same. It's not a separate, you know, it's not a separate identity or history. Yeah.
So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to play a clip actually from that episode as we continue talking about podcasts for the summer, podcasts you should tune into, especially as we're traveling. We know lots of folks have maybe a little bit more time in the summer. You can tweet your favorite podcasts to us. Our handle is 21STShow. We'd love to hear them. We can crowdsource that with all of our listeners. So send us a tweet or two about something you're listening to, and we'll share that with our audience. Right after the break, I'll continue this conversation with Kathy Irway, host of Self-Evident. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
I kind of distinctly remember my mother, when she would speak to her relatives back at home, she would kind of go into the bedroom and close the door. And I could kind of hear what she was saying, but I didn't understand because it was in Chabacano, which I didn't remember. So it was kind of like odd growing up. I kind of got a sense it was kind of a little secret box that you kind of keep in a corner. And you know, that was kind of the past for me. It was kind of in that little box.
That's a college student, a 22-year-old American college student named Julia Arcega, born in Manila, moved to the U.S. when she was just 5. One of the many voices featured in a new podcast that's just started in the past month or two. It's called Self-Evident. And as we're talking about different podcasts for you to listen to, this is one that features Asian American storytelling. The host, Kathy Irway, is speaking to us right now. So, Kathy, when we're thinking about that one, I wonder, as we were just talking about identity before the break, how, in this case, Julia was raised to think about her Filipina identity when she was growing up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, each, like, sort of detail of these stories leads to so many, like, rich insights and moments that you can maybe relate to. For instance, you know, being in a household where assimilation and English-only habits were the rule is something that maybe a lot of folks can you know, relate to.
No matter what language their parents spoke, right?
Right, yeah. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, both my parents actually spoke Chinese, but they would use it as a secret language for, like, bad stuff that they didn't want me and my brother to hear. So, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of experiences. And then there's today's episode that just dropped, episode 3. There's a character, there's actual storyteller who describes how his father would make him say things back to him in Tagalog whenever he said something in English. So there's flip sides to everything.
Right. Too. And then as we listen to Julia's sense of her identity changing, it was so interesting to me to think about, first of all, I like that you ask them, like, first of all, do you consider yourself Asian American? Because I think that's always a really complex question, right? It's not as simple as this label. How does that change for Julia?
Well, I think that Julia's an interesting example. She's young, and she's sort of getting into her own sense of what it means to be Asian American at this time. And she actually found a sense of community through listening to K-pop because, I mean, even though she's not Korean, that just vague sense of Asian Americanness and something like she thought to be cool and exciting was really inspiring for her.
So Kathy, it featured like that she was sort of these strong Asian women that are just also very fun, but that was really important to her.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, looking back, you know, having that representation in the media, whether it's in sports, whether it's in, you know, journalism or like podcasting, right? Or like pop music, it's really great to be able to like see someone who looks sort of like you reflected back, and even if it's not quite the same, and that leads to that sense of a broader Asian American identity, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think about when I was 22, you know, I would not have applied the label Asian American to myself. I would have said, oh no, my family's West Indian, you know, were from the Caribbean. I wouldn't have said like we're Indo-Caribbean. I mean, I think people's sense of their identity also changes. And then I wonder for you what you're hoping in terms of stories you're hoping to tell about as we see more Asian American storytelling and representation in the media, whether it's like Netflix, Always Be My Maybe, that's become really popular in the mainstream, or Crazy Rich Asians, or all of these things. What are you guys hoping to add to all of this?
Well, we want to tell stories that are personal, that are true, and then, like, you know, we don't gloss over or, like, shy away from the really hard questions. So we want to tackle the problems within the Asian American community as well, question ourselves, question, again, you know, in episode two, whether or not this label makes sense to everyone. So I think that what we want to do is take it a step further and reexamine all the things that we've been celebrating for good reason, but also, you know, taking it to another level of self-examination that can be tough sometimes.
Right. And I mean, the first episode, you really tackle that, featuring stories from history, like the when the U.S. Mm-hmm. government took away citizenship from naturalized citizens, and kind of really horrifying stories of one Indian who he committed suicide after the U.S. took his citizenship away. I wonder how important you think it is for all of us to be learning these stories from our country's history that maybe we're not learning in school.
Yeah, you know, those stories, I feel like a lot of folks have learned sort of Asian American History 101 that didn't cover, you know, all the spectrum of all the groups. That story in particular of Vaishnu Bagai, was we found out about it from Erica Lee's book, The Making of Asian America, which is actually a much more expansive history of Asian American, you know, groups. And I think that's a broader fields than maybe we've been learning in school.
That's Kathy Irway, host of Self Evident. As she said, their third podcast dropped, the third episode dropped today. You can check it out wherever you get your podcast. Kathy, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was great.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All week we were sharing podcasts we think you should listen to this summer. You can tweet your suggestions to us as well. Our handle's 21stshow. Ayman Ismail is another host who's having important conversations. His show focuses on what it means to be a man. It's appropriately titled Man Up. It debuted last month. Ayman, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on. This is amazing. Thanks for featuring Man Up.
You know, Ayman, I have to tell you, you actually inspired us doing this series because I was reading about this and I just thought there's so many good podcasts. Yeah, no, that is absolutely true. I read about it and I thought this would be a great thing for us to be talking about all of these different podcasts that are happening. You know, you're joining us from Slate. You wrote about, you know, how you were taught to become a certain kind of man. I mean, I was really struck by how personal this is for you. As you got older, you realized you didn't want to be like that. And so I just wanted to ask you about that. What kind of man were you taught to become when you were growing up?
Right. So my family, they come from Egypt, right? They immigrated in the 70s. So when they left Egypt, they left a particular kind of culture that existed in that time. So they weren't there when Egypt's culture was developing, and when they came to America, they tried to preserve that image of what Egyptian culture was supposed to be. So in a lot of ways, they were both resisting this American influence, this Western influence on their kids, but also they were trying to keep us in that same time capsule of a culture. So inevitably, we kind of drifted apart. We became you know, desensitized to the kinds of people that we were supposed to be, right? These old school traditional values. They had very clear senses of gender roles and what a man and what a man's job was and what a woman's job was. And that just created a lot of distance where me and my three siblings, we all needed to discover who we were meant to be on our own, in our own ways. So that left a lot of room for discovery. And when that happened, you know, it almost feels like, because now that I'm starting to think about what kind of family I want to have in my future, I've become a lot more conscious about the different impacts that small episodes of my life have had on what I think a man should be. So I'm really interested in trying to discover what other people what how other people feel about this idea of manning up and manhood and masculinity, and hopefully it'll introduce me to new ideas about what a man could be.
Right, and you also wrote when you started this that this is not an advice show. Why do you think that's important for people to know?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest parts about producing this series is how personal it is. I don't exactly know how I'm going to be going into every conversation. Every episode, I try to discover something new, both in the person I'm talking to and in myself. So it's really been an emotional roller coaster, and it's kind of hard to take a step back and make yourself vulnerable and try to trace where these ideas came from. And hopefully, I want to not only train myself to be more comfortable with my past, but also I want other people to open up with themselves and try to discover where these ideas came from so that they can hopefully learn some new ideas and maybe unlearn some old ones too.
Right. And so I wanted to set up a clip from your first episode. You talked to former national boxing champion Eric Kelly about fighting and manhood. I wonder, when we're thinking about the norms around manhood you grew up with, like fighting, what that was like.
Oh, man, do I have some stories for you. Fighting is one of those things where you need to, you kind of have to. Not that you want to fight all the time, but you have to let other kids know that if they want to pick on you or if they want to bully you, that it might not be so easy for them. You don't want to make yourself vulnerable. So I was interested in exploring that because I was worried. I was worried that might not be the right way to respond all the time. And I started diversifying my friends group, and I started traveling, and now I live in a totally different city where that's not appropriate. So I was interested in tracing back where those ideas came from. And I ended up learning a lot about myself and also how different my coming of age was than many other people around me, and how that kind of sometimes plays to my advantage, but in this case, like wanting to fight all the time, doesn't. So Eric Kelly was the first interview of the series. And I wanted to do this episode particularly because, for me, fighting was such a huge part of being a man. I wanted to know that I was capable of taking care of myself and also taking care of my family and the people around me. And when you grow up in an area like Newark, New Jersey, where I grew up, it was inevitable. You didn't always want to fight, but you had to, because fights would find you. And if you weren't capable of taking care of yourself, that would be known. And then other people who wanted to fight would kind of seek you out and make you a perpetual victim. And that's something that resonated also with Eric Kelly, who, you know, as a professional boxer, that's his career, was fighting.
Right, his whole job is
but
this.
He kind of, yeah, and he fell into it because he was so good at fighting in the street. But it ended up working against him, because after he came out of that environment where he didn't need to fight for survival anymore, he was still fighting outside the ring, and that ultimately led to the end of his career. I don't want to give away too much.
No, let's play a little. Yeah, let's play a little of this clip, and then we'll, yeah.
I've been in a fight when I was a kid, but I didn't really start to feel like a man until I got older, right?
Yes.
What turned us into men was figuring out how to uplift each other. The coolest kid on the block wasn't the kid that could fight the hardest. It was the kid that was making sure everybody else had something to eat.
Let me tell you something.
That's what I'm saying. Like
that's what makes you a good man.
So why can't...
Listen to me talk to
All right,
you.
Go ahead.
I'm going to tell you. What you just described to me is right, and it's a necessity, and it should be practiced all day, every day. I practice it. Mm. That's what makes you a good man, a good person. You think the world's filled with good people?
That's a former national boxing champion, Eric Kelly, in a conversation with Ayman Ismail. Ayman's on the line with us now from Slate, where he's the host of one of their new podcasts. It's called Man Up, talking about all of these issues.